or Shakespearean soliloquy. Capable of tremendous flashes of wrath or indignation, he was colorful in both action and speech. When he pontificated, he threw his feet up on the desk, jabbing his finger through the swirling cigar smoke, or jumped up from his seat, hair tousled, tie askew, to pace the floor with lawyerly deliberation. One colleague said he had a voice that thundered out of Sinai, and he knew no middle ground in advocating a cause. In a prose self-portrait, Gates described himself as eager, impetuous, insistent, and withal exacting and irritable. Like Rockefeller himself, Gates yoked together two separate selves, one shrewd and worldly, the other noble and high-flown. Born in upstate New York in 1853, not far from the Susquehanna River that flowed through Rockefeller's boyhood, Gates was the son of a high-minded, impecunious Baptist minister who had eked out a meager existence in small, impoverished towns. As a boy, Gates rebelled against the Puritan heritage that viewed earthly life as a melancholy sojourn. In his memoirs, he recalled that the singing was pleasing, but otherwise Sunday school was a bore, as was church. I remember well my weekly relief when it was over, and we could go home for dinner. Of his twice-daily prayers, he said, "If it taught anything, it taught us thus early that prayer is a mere empty form of words." The wonder was that the boy grew up to be a preacher. When Gates was a teenager, his father went to Kansas for the American Baptist Home Mission Society, which only aggravated the family's financial woes. Gates had to quit school at 15 to help pay off their debt. For several years he taught school and clerked in a dry goods store and a bank, storing up valuable business experience. After briefly attending Highland University in Kansas, he entered the University of Rochester in 1875, where his interest in religion was rekindled. A good Baptist, he would not dance, play cards, or frequent the theater. 2 years later, he entered the Rochester Theological Seminary, then under the sway of its president, Dr. Augustus H. Strong. Gates was briefly entranced by Strong's theological system. His instruction formed the foundation of our seminary course, and at that time it was almost wholly imaginary, was his later mordant judgment. Gates was drawn to the ministry, not as a retreat into another worldly life so much as a liberation from poverty and academic drudgery. After graduating from the seminary in 1880, Gates was assigned his first pastorate in Minnesota. When his young bride, Lucia Fowler Perkins, dropped dead from a massive internal hemorrhage after 16 months of marriage, the novice pastor not only suffered an erosion of faith, but began to question the competence of American doctors, a skepticism that later had far-reaching ramifications for Rockefeller's philanthropies. A period photo shows a handsome young man with a long, lean face, a handlebar mustache, and a somewhat wistful air. After launching into a zealous campaign to convert sinners, Gates soon lightened up, scrapping much of the scholastic baggage he had picked up in the seminary. To succeed as a pastor, he decided that he had to study the economic, intellectual, and social forces of his time. A biblical modernist, he employed science, history, and reason to explicate sacred texts. He also worked to retire the church's debt and wrote essays for the Minneapolis Tribune. After 8 years in Minnesota, Gates, thin and emaciated, seemed destined for a career as threadbare as his father's. Then, one day in 1888, heaven sent relief in the shape of a rich man, George A. Pillsbury, a founder of the Flower Fortune, the state's wealthiest Baptist, and then the mayor of Minneapolis. He told Gates in confidence that he suffered from an incurable disease and needed advice about making a $200,000 bequest to a local Baptist academy. Gates advised Pillsbury to start out by giving the academy $50,000, contingent on the Baptists raising an equal sum, what we would today call a matching grant, then leaving the remaining $150,000 in his will. Gates was subsequently drafted to drum up the $50,000, which he did so superlatively well that he threw up the ministry for good and became executive secretary of the new American Baptist Education Society. His contact with Rockefeller and involvement in the University of Chicago followed soon thereafter. Those Baptists who thought they had slipped an advocate into Rockefeller's inner sanctum were grievously disappointed. At first, Rockefeller still gave disproportionately to Baptist causes, as missionaries from every continent descended upon Gates's office in droves. But despite his fondness for Baptist clergy, Rockefeller was also exposed to many greedy, calculating pastors, and began to retreat from the sectarian spirit that had guided his giving. As Gates said, "I think his greatest trouble was with ministers because he had a natural liking for them and they were always trying to get money out of him." By 1895, Rockefeller told Gates that he wanted to give to the five main Protestant denominations. This delighted the lapsed minister, who had grown so dismayed by the Baptist church in his town of Montclair, New Jersey, that he had switched to the local Congregational church. He was increasingly convinced that Christ neither founded nor intended to found the Baptist church, nor any church. For someone like Gates, torn between heaven and earth, serving as Rockefeller's chief philanthropic advisor was an ideal synthesis. When they started working together in 1891, Rockefeller was 52 and Gates 38. In spite of his uncommon intelligence, Gates often felt self-conscious under Rockefeller's icy scrutiny. As he grew more comfortable in his presence, he developed a powerful loyalty to him. "I will do my best to serve in any business capacity," Gates humbly told him early on. "But I beg you not to place any confidence in me. I have little in myself, and to begin with matters in which I could not possibly do much harm." He ended by saying, "No one but my father has been so kind to me." Having long chafed at a minister's salary, Gates could now indulge his ripest fantasies of wealth. Where his father had made less than $400 a year, Gates started with Rockefeller at $4,000 a year, his salary rising to $32,000 by 1902. What Gates gave to his boss was no less vital. Rockefeller desperately needed intelligent assistance in donating his money at a time when he could not draw on a profession of philanthropic experts. Painstakingly thorough, Gates combined moral passion with great intellect. He spent his evenings bent over tomes of medicine, economics, history, and sociology, trying to improve himself and find clues on how best to govern philanthropy. Skeptical by nature, Gates saw a world crawling with quacks and frauds, and he enjoyed grilling people with trenchant questions to test their sincerity. Outspoken, uncompromising, he never hesitated to speak his piece to Rockefeller and was a peerless troubleshooter. Gates believed implicitly in Rockefeller's goodness and wisdom. "If he were placed in a group of, say, 20 of the greatest men of affairs of today," he once remarked in a speech, "before these giants had been with him for long, the most self-confident, self-assertive of them would be coming to him in private for his counsel." Having known many rich people, Gates was impressed that Rockefeller had no private yachts or railroad cars. He was always quick to defend Rockefeller, sometimes wittily. When a man complained to him that Rockefeller in his Cleveland years cared only for money, Gates retorted, "In heaven's name, what else could he do in that city?" In a typical utterance, Gates said, "The Rockefellers have done incomparably more to permanently enrich the Commonwealth than any other family since the founding of the Republic." Gates did not consider Rockefeller totally innocent in business, but he believed that whatever reprehensible deeds he had committed had simply reflected the business morals of his time. Yet he had no first-hand knowledge of the matter, for while he supervised Rockefeller's philanthropic and outside business investments, he was always excluded from anything pertaining to Standard Oil. As Junior said, "The oil companies didn't like him, and consequently I was the person who was the liaison." Since Gates entered the scene just as Rockefeller was retiring and was sequestered from his single largest holding, he had the luxury of believing in Rockefeller's innocence by assuming that he had behaved as well at Standard Oil as in his subsequent ventures. Significantly, Rockefeller surrounded himself in the early 1890s with brand new men who could defend his past with total sincerity and total ignorance. By recruiting subordinates who had never worked at Standard Oil, he had a chance for a fresh start, where he could make his behavior for the first time as ethical as his rhetoric. Led by Gates, these subordinates guaranteed that the Rockefeller millions were donated or invested scrupulously. Once he had an ex-pastor on the payroll, Rockefeller was necessarily kept on his best behavior, locked into a new moral regimen. Junior's presence at 26 Broadway further ensured that Father would behave more ethically than in the past. As at Standard Oil, Rockefeller encouraged independence, and once he had carefully trained his philanthropic lieutenants, he gave them a wide berth. Gates found his boss patient, kind, and considerate, but realized that Rockefeller's genial Midwestern manner and humor were something of a cover. His usual attitude towards all men was one of deep reserve, concealed beneath commonplaces and humorous anecdotes. He had the art with friends and guests of chatting freely, of calling out others, but of revealing little or nothing of his own innermost thoughts. When Gates went to the Oracle for guidance, he sometimes left more mystified than before. As he wrote of Rockefeller, "His deliberation was sometimes extreme, his reluctance to argue and speak out his thoughts fully, his skill in not exposing the slightest surface for attack, his long silences, so that we could not locate even his objections, were sometimes baffling." Rockefeller never offered blame or praise and revealed his opinion of employees only by adding or subtracting to their duties. His psyche was like a set of Chinese boxes. If you penetrated the outer wall, then you faced another wall, then another, ad infinitum. As Rockefeller moved into retirement, his wealth was accumulating at an astonishing rate. During his tenure at Standard Oil, the trust had usually paid a fixed dividend of 12%, reflecting his prudent leadership. With Archbold at the helm, by contrast, the dividends surged, jumping to 31% in 1896 and 33% in 1897 and 1899. Buoyed by these dividends, the price of Standard Oil shares leaped from 176 in 1896 to a high of 458. 3 years later. However much Rockefeller deplored this extravagant dividend policy, he was its foremost beneficiary, and it heightened the pressure on him to gear up his philanthropy to handle increasing amounts of money. With hundreds of appeals pouring in daily from around the world, Rockefeller made Gates promise that he would never forward begging letters to him or reveal his address. While Rockefeller continued to give out hundreds, if not thousands, of individual bequests to needy friends, relatives, and strangers, he sent one upstate cousin a pair of well-worn shoes, another an old suit. He increasingly followed a policy enunciated in an 1889 letter to Gates. "I am more and more disposed to give only through organized institutions." Gates executed this policy of wholesale giving faithfully, dismissing small requests for money with the fatal remark, "This is a retail business." Sometimes Rockefeller gave Gates glimpses into his inner sadness. One day Gates remarked to Rockefeller that benevolence was its own reward, that the man who looked for gratitude would die embittered. His only reply, uttered with deliberation and unwonted emphasis, was, "Don't I know that?" Gates saw that while he was always surrounded by people, Rockefeller had few, if any, real friends, and was isolated by his wealth. Visiting Rockefeller at a southern hotel around 1910, Gates found him rather lonely and forlorn and suggested he contact some cultivated local men. "Well, Mr. Gates," said Rockefeller, "if you suppose I have not thought about the matter, you are mistaken. I have made some experiments, and nearly always the result is the same. Along about the ninth hole out comes some proposition, charitable or financial." Rockefeller experienced more disenchantment with people in charity than in commerce, once telling his son, "I have lent and given people money and then seen them cross the street so that they would not have to speak to me." From the time he signed on as chief almoner, Gates knew his life had changed irrevocably. "I now saw myself largely cut off from disinterested friendships and almost of necessity a center of intrigue and dislike, he wrote in his memoirs. As he watched people scheme and grovel for Rockefeller's fortune, it was hard to preserve his faith in human nature. If you could be here in this office, he once wrote William Rainey Harper, explaining his own caution, and see the exhibition of human meanness and even dishonor among otherwise respectable men when they come to negotiate with Mr. Rockefeller's wealth, you would appreciate better than you can now how this perhaps unnatural caution has arisen. A close student of the boss's psychology, Gates was aware of Rockefeller's preferred self-image and played on it effectively. There was a manipulative side to Gates, as shown by a letter he wrote a friend in which he set forth 22 fundraising tips. Tip number 6 read, "If you find the prospective donor big with gift, do not rush him too eagerly to the birth. Let him take his time with gentle management. Make him feel that he is giving it, not that it is being taken from him with violence." Number 7 advised, "Appeal only to the noblest motives. His own mind will suggest to him the lower and selfish ones." One suspects Gates applied some of these pointers to Rockefeller himself, posing all the while as the faithful servant. Gates had a talent for dressing up proposals to Rockefeller with the right touch of historic drama. He made each gift seem a momentous advance in human civilization, and often mimicked Rockefeller's own business rhetoric, talking about educational trusts, for instance, to sell him a program. Gates knew that Rockefeller viewed himself as an instrument of God in business and philanthropy. By striking this note, Gates could always capture his mentor's attention. Many years later, Gates sent him the following New Year's greeting. "Certainly no man can survey your marvelous career without feeling that it bears in very high and special degree the marks of a plan of God. I remember well how your life has been to yourself a series of great surprises, how vistas altogether unexpected have suddenly opened before your astonished gaze, and now that you have arrived at a point when you can look back over a long course, how often and how deeply must it have impressed itself on your mind that you have been simply an instrument in the hands of the great power that is not ourselves. How clear must it now be to you in the retrospect that this great unseen power was guiding you all the time and ever to ends unseen, vaster, more varied, more far-reaching than any human wisdom could compass or conceive. If now at the beginning of this new year I may venture to offer you a toast, it would be John D. Rockefeller, his life, a plan of God." While Gates would function as a never-ending source of ideas for the philanthropies, it is important to credit Rockefeller's own contribution. The same mind that created the Standard Oil Empire was actively engaged in building up his charitable empire. As Gates noted, Rockefeller came to have hardly less pleasure in the organization of his philanthropy than in the efficiency of his business. In retirement, he actually gave more time to philanthropy than to investments. While Gates often generated ideas, Rockefeller never hesitated to wield his veto power or force Gates to rethink proposals. Gates had to take account of the many things that Rockefeller had ruled off-limits, such as funding social welfare agencies. He never had infinite freedom to draw up programs and needed to conform to Rockefeller's wishes. His power, if vast, was circumscribed. Rockefeller developed such a mystique of infallibility that people assumed his touch was no less unerring in his private investments than at Standard Oil. Whenever it was known that he had bought a stock, exultant investors rushed to join him. Sometimes Rockefeller contributed to his own myth. "It has always been my rule in business to make everything count," he once told an old friend, "to make every cent something. I never go into an enterprise unless I feel sure it is coming out all right." If he ever set eyes on that windy boast, Frederick T. Gates would have grinned, for he had found Rockefeller's personal finances in a shocking state, run haphazardly without a full-time portfolio manager. The mastermind of Standard Oil had proved to be a passive and easily hoodwinked investor. By 1890, as he banked $10 million in annual income, Rockefeller still deferred, with surprising credulity, to advice proffered by supposed friends. He fell particularly under the sway of two fellow congregants from the Fifth Avenue Baptist Church, Colgate Hoyt and Charles Colby. Hoyt often dropped by his house in the morning and accompanied him downtown, touting stocks all the while. Rockefeller reposed implicit faith in these two churchgoers, who induced him to pour millions into ruinous investments in a score of companies. Through their exertions, he acquired an investment empire that he knew solely from misleading figures on a statement. What reconciled Rockefeller to this setup was that he took minority stakes and imagined that his partners were investing equivalent amounts. As members of the executive committee of the Northern Pacific Railroad when Rockefeller was its major stockholder, Colby and Hoyt avidly pushed investments in timber stands of the Pacific Northwest. They planned to build up the town of Everett, Washington, at the juncture where the Northern Pacific would supposedly establish its major terminus on Puget Sound. As the Great Northern Railroad also neared completion, the whole area was convulsed by a speculative mania. Colby and Hoyt erred, however, in one small but costly matter. The Northern Pacific Terminal ended up in Tacoma, not Everett. Meanwhile, blindly following their counsel, Rockefeller had added mines, steel mills, paper mills, railroads, and even a nail factory to his holdings. Rockefeller's unwanted lack of vigilance owed something to his fragile health during the early 1890s, when he was trying to clear his mind of cares. Sensing that some of his outside investments might not be as sound as he advertised, he mentioned to Gates one day that if, on his philanthropic excursions, he happened to be near one of these investments, he might want to scout out the premises. While Rockefeller was already impressed by Gates's resourcefulness, he also knew that with Gates he risked less potential embarrassment than with a professional financial analyst who might broadcast his failures on Wall Street. Soon after Gates moved to New York in 1891, he was about to embark on a tour of Baptist schools in Alabama, when Rockefeller asked if he would inspect an iron furnace he had bought there on an old friend's advice. He said he was perplexed why it had fallen into a receiver's hands. When Gates filed his report, it was instantly clear that he was no courtier serving up syrupy lies to soothe his sovereign. The entire operation, Gates said bluntly, had nothing to do with iron, but was a thinly veiled attempt to boom local real estate. Many Baptist ministers had been tricked into buying nearby land that was supposed to appreciate because of its proximity to the iron operation. Rockefeller hid his amazement and contended breezily that he had taken this little flyer to help an old friend's son learn the iron business. By way of comparison, Rockefeller alluded to his lucrative iron business in Wisconsin, then allegedly yielding $1,000 per day. A few months later, he sent the intrepid Gates to take a look. Gates traveled to Wisconsin and with quiet tenacity began asking questions. He found exactly the same fraud as that perpetrated in Alabama. The ironworks were being used to pump up local real estate and auction off lots at inflated prices. The supposed profits were pure moonshine. Rockefeller was actually losing about $1,000 per day. To anyone who knew Rockefeller, the situation seemed inconceivable. He had made large investments without independently verifying the numbers sent by his friends. When he appeared at Forest Hill to relay the bad news, Gates knew that the boss could not dismiss $600,000 in mortgage bonds as a little flyer. And Rockefeller was visibly upset. As Gates recounted the meeting, "He was deeply agitated, and, had I not been able to give him the most positive assurances, would have been incredulous. He kept me with him at Forest Hill until he could get the old friend to his side from Wall Street, who had been mainly instrumental in selling him the bonds. This gentleman denied every one of my allegations, but he could only meet my proofs with protestations and tears of rage and apprehension." A few days later, the contrite scoundrel, whether Colby or Hoyt is unclear, returned to Rockefeller, confirmed the truth of Gates's allegations, and agreed to have the mortgage bond covenants rewritten. Shaken by this duplicity, Rockefeller sent his sleuth to probe his investment in the San Miguel Consolidated Mines high in the Rocky Mountains. The scheme's promoter had entertained many previous investors who had journeyed westward to tour the site. At once, Gates scented trouble when he quizzed a mining engineer in Denver about the San Miguel properties. "What?" the man shouted. "Do you mean to tell me that John D. Rockefeller has invested money in that damned swindle?" When Gates journeyed to Telluride, he learned that the mines were phantoms and that the company had only abandoned claims. At this point, it was now late 1892, Gates was still operating at one remove from Rockefeller in a nearby office in the Temple Court. After the San Miguel fiasco, Rockefeller moved him into his office at 26 Broadway. He saw that Gates had a flair for business that surpassed anything he had encountered at Standard Oil. In a stunning display of trust, Rockefeller gave him unrestricted access to his files for all investments outside of Standard Oil. As Gates poked around in this fetid swamp, he was appalled by what he found. "I unearthed some 20 of these sick and dying corporations," he recalled, "every one of which showed a balance sheet in red ink." As Gates sorted through the failed investments, George Rogers joined the chorus of those urging Rockefeller to institute new oversight procedures for his $23 million investment portfolio, including $14 million in railroad securities. Emboldened by Gates's findings, Rogers suggested creation of an executive committee. Gates would handle investments and benevolent matters. Gates's Montclair neighbor Star Murphy would assume legal responsibilities, and Rogers would take care of office matters, each to be paid $10,000 a year. As Rogers candidly told his chastened boss, "This will seem to you at first as very high, but it will be considerable cheaper than being robbed as you have been, and even now you are without exact knowledge as to many of the investments in which you have large sums involved." Pointing out the perils of passive investment, he suggested that Rockefeller assign deputies to oversee these companies. Beyond the shocking misrepresentation of his investments, Rockefeller had another dispiriting discovery in store. Hoyt and Colby had surreptitiously bailed out of the worthless operations and left him holding the bag, often with a majority stake. Even though he terminated relations with this pair, he could not dispose of their sour investments so easily, and thought the most prudent course was to buy total control of the companies and turn them around. Holding practically all the stock of 13 foundering companies, Rockefeller made Gates president of virtually all of them. Overnight, the young minister who had dreaded poverty was running two railroads, plus a far-flung group of mines, timber, and manufacturing concerns. Many of these highly speculative investments never panned out. As if born to rule business empires instead of saving souls, Gates operated with great swagger and panache. While he jettisoned many money-losing enterprises, he developed great affection for the Everett Timber and Investment Company, touring this terrain each year in a luxurious private railroad car. He bought up for Rockefeller all the forests in sight, a spree that finally netted 50,000 acres in Washington State and another 40,000 on Vancouver Island. Eventually, these timber tracts fetched 5 or 6 times their purchase price, compensating Rockefeller for the losses he had sustained in the Pacific Northwest debacle. Gates himself invested in several of the companies he managed for Rockefeller, and in 1902 he cashed in a tidy $500,000 profit. In Gates, Rockefeller had found not merely an able investor, but a prodigy. In 1917, asked by B.C. Forbes to name the greatest businessmen he had ever encountered, Rockefeller startled readers by skipping Flagler and Archbold, not to mention Henry Ford and Andrew Carnegie, and naming Frederick T. Gates. "He combines business skill and philanthropic aptitude to a higher degree than any other man I have ever known," stated Rockefeller. Enough Puritan guilt resided in Gates's soul that he always stressed his charitable work and deprecated his business exploits. When Adolph Ox, publisher of the New York Times, asked for background information about him in 1912, Gates replied modestly, even evasively, "While I have had intimate relation with Mr. Rockefeller's private business, that is, his private and personal investments, my interests are and always have been rather in his benevolent work than in his business." This would have been news to many on Wall Street who had experienced the temper of this hard-driving, cigar-smoking, flamboyant majordomo of the world's largest private fortune. Even though he stayed in the background, the press soon detected the power held by the eccentric, shaggy-haired Gates. In appearance, Mr. Gates is not the ordinary type of financier, the New York Daily Tribune noted. Everything about him, from the carelessly brushed iron-gray hair and cropped mustache to his feet, indicate breezy indifference to what others may think about him. Investment houses trifled with him at their peril, for Gates oversaw a securities portfolio of unprecedented size for a private individual. At a time of thin capital markets, he needed to scrounge to find gilt-edged securities to absorb the Rockefeller millions. As if he were a one-man investment bank, Rockefeller participated under Gates' supervision in major stock and bond underwriting syndicates alongside the most august Wall Street houses. While it was not unusual in that era for rich individuals to complete syndicates, the sheer scope of Rockefeller's involvement was something novel. Even in old age, Rockefeller received stock quotes twice daily and could rattle off the precise number of shares he owned in many stocks. He adhered to several hallowed investing rules. Perhaps the most sacred was that Gates not disturb his Standard Oil stock, the bulk of his fortune. As at Standard Oil, Rockefeller insisted upon keeping a cash balance that never dipped below $10 million. Since he also had a sizable stake in U.S. government bonds, he felt he could play the market with impunity. A born contrarian, Rockefeller insisted upon buying in declining markets and selling in rising ones. When accumulating a position, he bought stocks each time they declined an eighth of a point. When unwinding a position, he sold each time the stock rose an eighth of a point, a technique that gave him an average over an extended period. Having twice been sued by people for offering incorrect market advice, he refrained from offering stock tips. There was also some genuine humility at work, for Rockefeller admitted that he had no prophetic vision as would make me try to mislead anybody else by one of my miserable guesses. Since his aides superintended a royal treasury of securities, he had to implement special security precautions. He laid down an ironclad rule that no employee could invest in stocks or bonds of any company in which he held a major stake, and a minimum of two people had to be present whenever the safe housing his securities was opened. Rockefeller's subordinates seemed more jittery than their phlegmatic boss about dealing with such stupendous sums. Star Murphy recalled an occasion when the boss asked him and a colleague to bring $60 million in securities to his Pocantico estate for his personal inspection. With no small dread, the two men drove up to Westchester, totally unguarded. Rockefeller did not show any anxiety about the absence of security, and only at the end alluded to the situation by remarking, with deadpan face and humorous drawl, "I suppose that you gentlemen will return to New York together." Efforts to manipulate Rockefeller often backfired after the Colby and Hoyt affair. In 1910, for instance, Rockefeller was vacationing in Augusta, Georgia, when he received a visit in his hotel suite from Henry Clay Frick, who solemnly advised him to buy 50,000 shares of Reading Railroad stock. The moment Frick left, Rockefeller got on the phone and issued orders to liquidate his block of 47,500 shares. He had the satisfaction of selling the final 2,500 shares at the stock's peak. Rockefeller grappled with the classic dilemma faced by all large investors: how to buy stocks without pumping them up or sell without dragging them down. As his fame spread, his market moves could set off frenzied stampedes of traders. To forestall this, Rockefeller employed a double set of brokers. A primary broker parceled out orders among dozens of secondary brokers who were ignorant of his identity, thus masking his steps behind a maze of intermediaries. For a long time, he paid double commissions before he worked out a single commission arrangement with a broker named Paul D. Langdon. On Fantasiecle Wall Street, stock pools were both legal and voguish, and Rockefeller had no ethical qualms about participating in them. Entering the autumnal phase of his life, Rockefeller preferred sure, steady gains to speculative killings. When one promoter tried to peddle some gold mining shares, Gates cut him off short. If you were to say that the vein was pure gold, 24 carats fine, broad, easily workable, and close to a railway to be had for a song, I doubt if Mr. Rockefeller's attention would be attracted. He has come to a time in life and circumstances in fortune when these things no longer attract his cupidity. Rockefeller seldom responded to the countless inventors who trooped to his office hoping to sell patents. It was easier to lend large sums, backed by first-class securities as collateral, than to have investments dispersed among dozens of enterprises. For all his fabled rapacity, Rockefeller was a forgiving lender and, by all accounts, lenient to a fault. Never have I known Mr. Rockefeller to call a private loan, foreclose a private mortgage, or oppress a debtor, complained Gates. Another investment advisor, Henry E. Cooper, concurred. He was never too hard on people in business. He was too easy. To finance sporadic stock market forays, Rockefeller borrowed huge sums from banks, up to 15 or 20 million at a time, pledging his government bonds as collateral. This was all a trifle confusing for Junior, who continued to take his father's straight-laced pronouncements against speculative investing at face value. As he moved into middle age, the son even took to lecturing his wayward father, chiding him with his own rhetoric. On the eve of World War I, when Senior's borrowings swelled to nearly $10 million, Junior reminded him of how he had frequently given utterance to my belief that you should never be a borrower but always long of cash. For a long time, Rockefeller resisted efforts to professionalize his investment team, and Gates soldiered on as best he could. In 1897, Charles O. Hite, later Rockefeller's expert on real estate matters, joined the staff, followed a few years later by Bertram Cutler, who helped manage the family investments for the next 50 years. Even with this team in place, the investment operation was still slipshod, and in 1907, Gates told Rockefeller, "I have long thought that it would prove helpful if you could have a man in the office who had before him at all times every day the complete list of your investments, and whose business it is to familiarize himself intimately with every one of them, to have his finger, so to speak, on the pulse of every one of them all the time." The following year, Rockefeller finally capitulated and formed a four-member committee, including Gates and Junior, to manage his money. As with the Rockefeller philanthropies, Gates operated tentatively at first in the wolfish world of Wall Street, but was soon very much master of the situation. Before long, he confidently conveyed to Rockefeller his scathing opinions of such globe-straddling moguls as Andrew Carnegie and J. Pierpont Morgan. At the time, the world of high finance revolved around a spirited rivalry between Morgan and Jacob Schiff of Kuhn Loeb. Convinced that Rockefeller was already controversial enough, Gates tried, whenever possible, to avoid clashes between these two financiers, and he balked at joining boardroom revolts, stock market squeezes, and other activities that might bring Rockefeller into any further disrepute. Famished for blue-chip securities, Gates clamored for inclusion in both J.P. Morgan & Company and Kuhn Loeb syndicates, but always believed that he got superior treatment from Kuhn Loeb. Under the aegis of this house, Rockefeller swallowed huge chunks of railroad issues, including giant stakes in the Southern Pacific, the Union Pacific, and the Pennsylvania Railroads. He also took a large share in loans floated for the Imperial Japanese government in 1904 to 1905 during the Russo-Japanese War, and for the Chinese government in 1911. He contributed to Kuhn Loeb's consolidation of the Chicago meatpackers, led by Armour and Swift, helping to foster another trust. Constantly on the prowl for good securities, he sometimes bought from Kuhn Loeb just to maintain harmonious relations. Gates and his minions smarted at the high-handed treatment they received from J.P. Morgan & Company, where they were routinely assigned small portions of mediocre issues. Curious treatment for the world's richest investor. In the early 1900s, Rockefeller found himself with disconcerting frequency involved in Morgan's biggest blunders, including the Chicago Street Railway that he financed for the magnate Charles Yerkes, and the International Mercantile Marine, Morgan's abortive effort to forge a North Atlantic shipping cartel. For Rockefeller, this was not happenstance, but reflected Morgan's settled antipathy. Bruised by these bad investments, Rockefeller told his son in 1911, "In future, when investments are offered us by this house, we will be of one mind, I think, in accepting nothing which we do not all agree is very desirable for us to have." After J.P. Morgan Sr. died in 1913, Rockefeller told his advisers to keep up cordial relations with the Morgan Bank, while tartly reminding them that, "We have had sufficient experience with the House of Morgan and Company in the role of pack horses for their poor investments." In spite of his phalanx of able advisers, Rockefeller had a very uneven record as an investor. Among his triumphs, he extended a $6 million loan to the fledgling General Motors in 1906, about $98 million today, taking notes for his cash. When the notes were paid off, Rockefeller took payment in General Motors shares, which then obligingly soared from 200 to 1500. He also fared well as the premier investor in Consolidation Coal and the B&O Railroad. Yet Rockefeller could stumble abysmally, as evidenced by his mystifying relationship with George Gould. When Jay Gould, who had memorably looted the Erie Railroad, died in late 1892, leaving an estate of more than $100 million, his 28-year-old spendthrift son George inherited his investments. He proved an unlikely business partner for Rockefeller. Where Rockefeller frowned upon the expense of private railroad cars, George Gould owned an entire train and savored the patrician pleasures of fencing, hunting, yachting, and polo. The New York tabloids also delighted in reporting upon his racy relations with women. Whatever his misgivings about George's philandering, Rockefeller was attracted by the Missouri Pacific and other western railroads that Gould wanted to weld into a transcontinental empire. In 1902, Rockefeller took giant portions of a Missouri Pacific stock offering, and before long, he had buried $40 million in this graveyard, as much as George Gould himself had. Troubles soon developed. In 1906, irate over Gould's profligate spending and failure to consult him, Rockefeller had his son withdraw from the Missouri Pacific Board. By 1909, Rockefeller felt so abominably treated by Gould that he refused further cooperation unless his representatives controlled the board. As the price of rescuing the Missouri Pacific, Jacob Schiff of Kuhn Loeb likewise insisted upon heavy board representation. When Gould finally resigned the presidency, he installed a crony in his stead, leading Gates to declare it high time to terminate relations with the mad failed Gould. In 1912, Rockefeller unloaded his holdings in the Missouri Pacific stock, ending the misadventure. Starting in the late 1890s, newspapers published sensational accounts of a shadowy cabal known on Wall Street as the Standard Oil crowd. As diarist Henry Clews recorded, a new order had come due to the most powerful influence that had ever manifested itself in Wall Street. This influence was very largely composed of the Standard Oil Combination, who introduced in their Wall Street operations the same quiet, unostentatious, but resistless measures that they had always employed in the conduct of their corporate affairs. It was popularly assumed that John D. Rockefeller masterminded these diabolical exploits and was determined to digest Wall Street itself. "It has been said that I control all the banks, all the trust companies, all the insurance companies, even all the railroads in the United States," a chagrined Rockefeller told one reporter in 1906. "Will you believe me when I say that I do not own a controlling interest in any bank, trust company, or insurance company?" Rockefeller dabbled in stocks more than he admitted, but he was largely a passive investor and remained as leery of Wall Street as any Cracker Barrel populist. Once pressed for investment advice, he retorted, "I suppose if I were to give advice, it would be to keep out of Wall Street." When he bought a seat on the New York Stock Exchange in 1883, he made an obligatory appearance before the admissions committee, then avoided the exchange for the next 54 years. He proudly pointed out that during his tenure, Standard Oil was never listed on the exchange, and that management's attention was directed to the administration of the business rather than to the stock gambling. Although he never issued a public refutation, Rockefeller played no part in the Standard Oil crowd and cringed at the exploits of its three mainstays, Henry H. Rogers, James Stillman, and his own brother William. Rogers and William paid for their speculations with Standard Oil checks, a practice that always riled John D. While John always professed warm friendship for his brother, their values had radically diverged over the years as William became a typical grandee of the Gilded Age and plunged lustily into a world of fashionable clubs and resorts. Having sold much of his Standard Oil stock to his brother, William was not nearly as rich as John, but he was still one of the six major recipients of Standard Oil stock and was often listed among the 10 richest Americans. A connoisseur of the good life, he loved cocktails, gambling, fast-trotting horses, hunting, fishing, opera, theater, and yachts. His Fifth Avenue mansion faced Alva Vanderbilt's French limestone chateau, and he frequented her costume balls. His weekend house, Rockwood Hall, a vast pile of towers and turrets, with 204 rooms and gardens landscaped by Frederick Law Olmsted, loomed over the Hudson River. He also had a rugged Adirondack estate of several thousand acres. In 1888, along with such moguls as J.P. Morgan, William K. Vanderbilt, and Cyrus McCormick, William founded the Jekyll Island Club, the posh resort of the 100 millionaires, on an island off the Georgia coast that soon boasted roads with names such as Morgan Road and Rockefeller Path. In his later years, William traded in his Baptist upbringing for a more Epicurean life. "I used to be very much interested in the church," he told a friend in later years, "but I haven't attended for many a day." Unlike John, William gave little to charity and turned a deaf ear to John's entreaties to contribute to the University of Chicago. At one point, when pressing William to help build a church, John needled him by saying, "Paintings are good. This would be better." William was more jaundiced than John was about the motives of people who solicited his money. It was in their stock market operations that the two brothers differed most, so much so that John stayed aloof from enterprises in which William was involved. In declining a proposed investment, John simply told his financial staff, "No, that is William's," and that ended all discussion. As a denizen of Wall Street, William was often found in his downtown office, puffing on a cigar and glancing at a stock ticker by the window. Besides being president of Standard Oil of New York, he was a director of 40 companies, including railroads, banks, and copper mines, plus steamship, gas, and water companies. What irked John was that William engaged in stock promotions and market raids and other activities that he equated with gambling and manipulation. It might have been friction over this issue that caused their relationship to cool in the late 1890s. In 1897, John omitted William's name alone from a list of top Standard Oil executives slated to receive large salary increases, prompting this plaintive protest from Flagler. "I wish you would include Will from a purely business standpoint. I think he is worth as much as the younger of the three others, and I doubt if you realize what a reflection upon him it would seem to be left out. The last day of this month will round out 30 years since I joined you and Will in business. Do not let us at this late day do anything that will have the appearance even of unkindness. I think I know Will's personal feeling for you better than you do. It is far more kindly than you imagine." John held back from William's stock market deals in part because he associated them with James Stillman, who, on the strength of his Standard Oil connections and his friendship with William, had converted National City Bank into New York's largest bank. "I like William," said Stillman, a darkly elegant, taciturn man, "because we don't have to talk. Often we sit 15 minutes in silence before one of us breaks it." They were an oddly matched pair, William good-natured and easygoing, Stillman an icy individual who played his cards close to the vest. One of Stillman's descendants left this description of him: Stern, brooding, forever silent except when dropping sardonic remarks, he was known on Wall Street as the man with the iron mask. At one point, Stillman feuded with his wife and banished her forever from the house, forbidding his five children from mentioning her name. The rapport between James Stillman and William Rockefeller was transferred to their children. Stillman's daughters, Elsie and Isabel, married William's sons, William G. and Percy, breeding a line of Stillman Rockefellers who would be central figures in the subsequent history of National City Bank, today's Citicorp. Many contemporary critics assumed that John D. formed an investing triumvirate with his brother and Stillman. In fact, he had serious reservations about Stillman's character and regretted his friendship with William. Evidently, Stillman repaid the compliment. One day, he dropped by 26 Broadway to visit William, strolled over to Junior's desk, and proceeded to make derogatory comments about Senior. At once, Junior rose stiffly to his feet, spluttering, "Mr. Stillman, you can say those things to my father, but you can't say them to his son. Good day." In spite of their uneasy relationship, Stillman invited Junior to become a National City Bank director in 1901. Junior was tempted to accept, but feared that Stillman's rival J.P. Morgan might retaliate by excluding his father from underwriting syndicates. Senior was more concerned that the appointment might lend credence to the bothersome canard that he held a major stake in National City Bank. If Junior took the position, Senior warned him, it might seem to indicate a closer relation in that quarter than really exists, or would be wise for us to publish to the world. For once defying his father's wishes, Junior joined the National City Bank board. Senior, relenting, bought 10,000 shares of the bank's stock. As it turned out, Junior resigned from the bank board the following year, finding some of its practices questionable. The significance of Senior's stake in National City Bank should not be overstated. A 1906 statement of his holdings shows that he had $415,000 invested in the bank, as opposed to $375,000 in the First National Bank, controlled by Morgan's crony George F. Baker, while his largest bank holding was $1.4 million in New York Trust, dominated by the Harkness family. He also bought a substantial stake in Bankers Trust when it was started in 1903. In general, Rockefeller deliberately avoided National City Bank and the Standard Oil crowd, but he chose never to make that public and thought it unconscionably craven that William, Stillman, and Henry Rogers failed to disabuse the press. Once asked privately about Stillman's bank, he replied dryly, "It is called, I am told, the Rockefeller Institution, but I don't control it. I have perhaps $300,000 of its stock, and its capital is $200 million. I have never been in the building in my life. Why, I declare I don't even know where it is located." Rockefeller did acquire a major interest in one bank. After the Armstrong investigation of 1905 exposed massive double-dealing between insurance companies and their bankers, reform legislation was enacted in 1911 that forced the Equitable Life Assurance Company to spin off its subsidiary, the Equitable Trust Company. Seizing this chance, Rockefeller, George Gould, and Kuhn Loeb took control, with Rockefeller the principal shareholder. Rockefeller hoped to participate in the bank's lucrative financial operations and soon urged all companies within the Standard Oil universe to switch their accounts to the bank. Profiting from the Rockefeller tie, the Equitable Trust became within a decade America's eighth largest bank. The move was fraught with significance for the Rockefellers, for the bank was to merge with the Chase Bank following the 1929 crash. The resulting institution would be the fortress of Rockefeller family finance. If the descendants of William Rockefeller were identified with National City, the progeny of John D. were always associated with Chase. Of the three principals in the Standard Oil crowd, Rogers, Stillman, and William Rockefeller, it was Henry H. Rogers who most entranced the public. In the pantheon of Standard directors, nobody save John D. himself achieved wider fame. There was something lithe and lethal, charming and fierce about Rogers that made him a magnetic figure even to those he repelled. At Standard Oil, they affectionately dubbed him the Savage Old Tiger, while Wall Street, taking his initials, christened him Hellhound Rogers. He was a handsome and athletic man with a theatrical mustache, a sharp gaze, and a swashbuckling aura. Rogers had a chameleon personality. He could be sensitive and generous one moment, a pitiless foe the next. In Manhattan clubs and drawing rooms, he charmed companions, relating hilarious stories and playing a wicked game of poker. He was also very charitable. He helped Colonel Edwin Drake's impoverished widow and also built a school, library, church, parish house, and Masonic hall in his hometown of Fairhaven, Massachusetts. "He looked at you and he owned you," said one Standard Oil colleague, fascinated by his kaleidoscopic moods. "He was affable unless you tramped on his little toe. He was a man of the fiercest likes and dislikes that I ever knew in the business." "His expression could transform itself totally while he blinked his eyes," a reporter wrote in the Evening Post. "His voice could travel through the scale of vindictiveness, indifference, politeness, affability, and friendliness in a single sentence." Rogers's journey from an impecunious boyhood to the summit of Wall Street affluence was startling. A sea captain's son, he spent his adolescence clerking in a grocery store, hawking newspapers, and working on a railroad before setting off with a friend to operate a small refinery outside Oil City. Through a mutual friend, he was introduced to Charles Pratt, who bought his operation and ushered him into the Standard Oil fold. Had he stuck to oil, Rogers would have fared far better in his relations with Rockefeller, who thought he divided both his time and loyalty. From his elegant mahogany office, decorated with small bronze bulls and bears, Rogers hatched deals by the dozen, forcing reporters to work full-time to track his machinations. At one point, he became the veritable czar of Staten Island, controlling its trolleys, railroads, ferries, and electric and gas companies. In 1884, he and William Rockefeller formed the Consolidated Gas Company to provide gas to Brooklyn, and he also vied with J. Edward Addicks for control of Boston Gas. With his executive flair, Rogers thought he was the ideal candidate to succeed Rockefeller, and he was elevated to vice president of the trust in 1890. He therefore bristled when Archbold was tapped for the top spot. The decision was partly a question of style. Rockefeller was irked by Rogers's gambling and profanity, his strutting in public and mingling with high society. Rockefeller also favored Archbold because he was wedded to Standard Oil business, whereas Rogers was often distracted by other interests. Rogers sometimes bullied Standard Oil subordinates to starve his gas competitors of needed oil, even if this hurt Standard profits, a cardinal sin in Rockefeller's view. The flashpoint in the feud between Rockefeller and Rogers came in 1899, when James Stillman, William Rockefeller, and Rogers acquired secret control of Anaconda Copper of Butte, Montana, a mining venture formerly owned by Senator George Hearst. They made the purchase with a $39 million loan from National City Bank. They then turned around, restyled the new holding company Amalgamated Copper, and fobbed it off on a gullible public for $75 million. Retiring the $39 million loan and pocketing a $36 million profit. Rockefeller was incensed by the issuance of so much watered stock, which gave him a chance to feel self-righteous when his own virtue was under attack. The new company was floated by Stillman and National City Bank, and both William and Rogers exploited their Standard Oil connections to stoke a speculative fever. To execute this deal, Rogers made the mistake of inviting a sharp-eyed Boston stockbroker named Thomas W. Lawson into the project. Starting in July 1904, Lawson published a tell-all account in Everybody's Magazine that was later collected into a classic volume entitled Frenzied Finance. The most melodramatic potboiler in American financial history, the book opened with this histrionic dedication: "To penitents, that those whose deviltry is exposed within its pages may see in a true light the wrongs they have wrought and repent." Describing himself as a mere neophyte in crime, Lawson gave his exposé a confessional note. I have unwittingly been made the instrument by which thousands upon thousands of investors in America and Europe have been plundered. The gist of his indictment was that the public paid two-thirds of the purchase price for Amalgamated Copper, while Rogers and his comrades took two-thirds of the stock. At the time, Lawson noted, Standard Oil was considered the greatest power in the land, and its supposed involvement had stimulated a buying mania. At the subscription deadline on May 4, 1899, mobs had formed outside National City Bank, and four burly policemen had to shut the doors against these disappointed investors. With the offering five times oversubscribed, Rogers handed out preferred allotments to favored politicians. Rogers and William Rockefeller had lured investors with the promise of their own involvement, but they dumped stock soon after it was issued. Lawson's character sketches were as memorable as his revelations about the syndicate's methods. Oddly, he expressed affection for William Rockefeller, whom he portrayed as solid, laconic, and far more trustworthy than Rogers. In Henry Rogers, he found his true protagonist, a mutable man of violent extremes, an actor of genius who got lost in the many roles he shuffled. Yet away from the intoxicating spell of dollar-making, this remarkable man is one of the most charming and lovable human beings I have ever encountered. A man whom any man or woman would be proud to have for a brother. Once he passes under the baleful influence of the machine, however, he becomes a relentless, ravenous creature, pitiless as a shark, knowing no law of God or man in the execution of his purpose. By liberally splashing the names Rockefeller and Standard Oil across his pages, Lawson made it seem as if John D. had formed a conspiratorial trio with Rogers and William. At one point, he said more truthfully, "It was the first venture of size these two strong wheelmen, Rogers and William, of Standard Oil had undertaken without the cooperation of John D. Rockefeller, and it appeared that he was considerably worked up over the public hubbub, and so opposed to the whole amalgamated affair that nothing short of a great success could justify his subordinates' temerity." In a footnote, Lawson further conceded that Rockefeller never put a dime into the amalgamated flotation. Nevertheless, the general public came away with the impression that John D. was pulling the strings. At one point, Lawson quoted Rogers's views on the merits of cartels versus competition. "No man has ever done his business properly who has missed a single dollar he could have secured in the doing of it. It is one of the first principles Mr. Rockefeller taught me. It is one he has inculcated in every Standard Oil man, until today it is a religion with us all." While Rogers was talking in general terms, it again left the impression that John D. lurked somewhere behind the Copper Trust. Had he not been unfairly implicated, Rockefeller might have enjoyed the rebuke delivered to Rogers. When the Lawson series began, Junior rushed him a copy, declaring, "I think you will be well repaid for reading this article, although it seems to be written in a bitter, vituperative, sensational manner." Any such satisfaction, however, paled before the sense that he had been unjustly slandered. "They said I owned copper stock. That Boston man said it. When, as a matter of fact, it belonged to my partners and I had nothing to do with it." He was still seething years later. It was not pleasant to sit still and take all the abuse and not hear one word of explanation from them. Rockefeller suffered in silence, knowing that if he spoke up, he would have to repudiate his brother. After the Lawson series, John D. and Rogers saw each other only twice during the next 5 years. In early 1907, Rockefeller took revenge against Rogers at a meeting of Standard Oil's board of directors. After investing millions of his own money in the Virginia Railway, a coal-carrying railroad in Virginia, Rogers could no longer carry the debt and sought relief from Standard Oil. Spying his chance to cut Rogers down to size, Rockefeller told his partners, "Gentlemen, we should not, as an organization, become involved in other corporations or side issues. We are making money and success as an oil corporation, and we should confine our efforts to Standard alone." When a vote was taken, Rockefeller prevailed, and Rogers grew so enraged that he slammed his fist on the table, threatening to sell every share of Standard Oil stock he owned. To this Rockefeller placidly replied, "What is your price?" When Rogers named it, Rockefeller rejoined, "I will meet you here with a certified check tomorrow at 10. The next day, in an incalculable blunder, Rogers handed over his block of Standard Oil stock to Rockefeller, surrendering in a moment of pique a vast fortune in future dividends and appreciation. As we shall see shortly, Rockefeller might have had more than the Lawson series on his mind, for he thought that Rogers had played a treacherous trick on him by meeting with Ida Tarbell. Posterity has received another portrait of Henry H. Rogers, and given the power of the pen that drew it, it has been an imperishable one. Something of a literary man, Rogers had long admired Mark Twain and read his books aloud to his children. "If I ever meet that man," he once commented, "I'd like to do something for him." He thus responded with alacrity in 1893, when Twain's friend Clarence Rice asked if Rogers would meet the author at the Murray Hill Hotel to discuss the bankruptcy of Twain's